Session number 8736, rule number 34.
Lord Harding, tape 34. Yes, you were telling me about this meeting you had with Eisenhower and the others.
Well, it was a meeting. It was somewhere down in the south. I can't remember where it was now. But each of the commands were invited or asked to present their plans. And that raised an important question for me, because I hold the view that a commander is responsible, totally responsible for his plan, and I decided that I would present my general plan of defense myself. The general habit I found of the Americans and probably to a lesser extent the French was to get their various staff officers involved, like the chief of staff, the head of the artillery, and so on, to deal with the plan in segments, so to speak, on their own. And I thought, no, I won't do that. I will present the plan myself, because I'm responsible for it. And that was something I learned at that time, that the commander is the one who decides on the plan. I learned this, really, from Monty, of course. And so I decided to do it that way. So we did our presentation rather differently from the others. Instead of a series of staff officers appearing on the rostrum or whatever you call it, giving their part of the plan in sections, I gave my plan in an overall picture, a statement of a presentation of my plan, and then. And details were filled in by the various staff officers concerned where necessary. Now that was a change that I made, and I think it was right.
What were the features of your plan? Can you remember the main sort of thrust of it?
No, I can't. No, I don't remember the detail of it at all. All I remember was that. I think the general plan was to hold the line of the Weser as a delaying position, not as the final defense position, but as a delaying position, and then to withdraw if necessary under pressure, and stand on the line of the Rhine. That was in general terms the plan, I think.
Of course, by this time, the Russians had exploded an A-bomb, hadn't they? Did this sort of make any difference to strategic planning at that stage?
Not at that stage, no. No, I don't think so.
We were still thinking in terms of
a conventional campaign without the use of nuclear weapons. No, it was early days for that. We didn't include thinking about the effect of the use of nuclear weapons, and after all, there weren't very many of them, and the Americans still had a complete superiority in the nuclear field, and so we weren't concerned. At least I wasn't concerned that the Russians might use their nuclear weapons in an offensive against Western Europe.
What sort of effects had the Berlin blockade made on this sort of atmosphere in Germany? Was there increased tension, do you think, because of
that? Not as far as the troops are concerned, no, I don't think so. I think that problem of the airlift to Berlin was, of course, a very important one. But that was primarily an air plan, and it affected the garrisons in Berlin, the British garrison there. I wasn't conscious of any increase in or change in in temperature or anything like that. Myself, I don't remember being conscious of anything of that kind. No, it was always a matter of great anxiety as to what extent we could hold a Russian offensive in the forward line, and the conduct of a withdrawal across the northern plain of Germany would have been a very complicated and difficult operation. And that was enough to think about without getting involved in other things. And there was the problem of the how the Dutch and the Belgian contingents or armies would fit in, and what performance they would put up. And so that I had a great deal of discussion with the two commanders in chief, the Belgian and the Dutch. As far as the Dutch were concerned, I was very anxious to get them to agree to a more forward deployment and a more higher state of readiness of their reserves. So I asked General Hosselmann, who was the chief of staff, the Dutch chief of staff, to come up and discuss the matter with me. He came up. I remember it very well. It was in the winter. It must have been the winter of 51, 52. And it was a cold day, and he arrived, and he was to stay the night, and arrived in the middle of the afternoon. And so I took him out, we walked, and said we'd like some exercise, and we walked round and round my garden, getting colder and colder, while we discussed plans. And I eventually thought I'd got him to agree to what I wanted. That was a more forward deployment of the Dutch divisions, and a great higher state of readiness on generally, and particularly of their reserves. And so I said, all right, well, I'm glad we agree that this is what should be done. Come along in now and have a drink. And we've got some people coming to dinner to meet you. And then I'll get my chief of staff to write out, prepare an Edmore, and take you along to my headquarters tomorrow morning, and then we can see if it fits in with what you understand by what we have agreed. And that'll be that. And that's what happened. And Cuthbert Sugden, who was the first absolutely excellent chief of staff, he produced an aide memoir. And we went to Hosselmann. I took Hosselmann into headquarters in Bad Einhausen in the morning. He read it through and checked it. We talked about it for a bit, and then he said, there, yes, he agreed with that, and took away a copy, and I thought that was fine. And I thought that, well, anyway, that's a step forward. But then he said he must consult his government. And about a week later, I was going out somewhere, but I always used to go into the office before going off to see some troops or visits or something. And I found on my desk a copy of Winston Churchill's Life of Marlborough, open at a certain page. And then I saw there was a letter from Hosselmann, or signal from Hosselmann, saying that after consultations with his government, he couldn't agree. They would not agree to the plans that we had agreed between us. He was very sorry. And then I looked at this book, which was open at a certain page, and I saw that Cuthbert Sugden had opened it at a stage where Marlborough had reached agreement with his Dutch commanders about certain parts, and the thing had been altered or prevented. And, put out of business by the Dutch commissioners. So, as you know, we said, thought to ourselves, well, history repeats itself. I had a good deal of discussions with, what his name, I can't remember now, the Belgian commander, who was again rather a flamboyant sort of chap, but worked with the British forces in the final campaign in Germany. And there was a problem. There were problems with both of them because they had had to get their governments to agree to what they agree with me, and this presented difficulties because both of cooperation, and of course one of the main problems, and still is a problem, for the NATO forces in Western Europe is the absolute failure on the part of the various governments involved to agree to carry out any really effective plan of the standardization of equipment and weapons. And that was a very obvious problem there, and it still, in my opinion, is a problem. Because it means that the various allied forces, armies in particular, are inflexible, and that I think remains a disadvantage and a handicap.
Were you able to voice your anxiety about that?
Well, of course. Yes.
But nothing was done.
Well, it gets into the international arena. And then it's discussed by the NATO chiefs of staffs, and then it's discussed in the various governments. But you see, in that field, national armament industries have a very strong voice. And the Americans in particular, in fact, later on when I was working with a Plessy company, we used to refer to American attitude to any sort of interchange of equipment and manufacturing and research. The American doctrine was NIY, NYI, NYH, not invented here. And that, I think, applies to all the nations and still does apply.
Yes, I suppose the
interests of the national armament industries, they're the interests of the national governments. And the national barriers still remain, and they create a big handicap, I think, for the complete flexibility and interchange of units and formations for the NATO forces, particularly the land forces.
But I suppose looking at the other side, you know, the Soviet bloc, they have the advantage, haven't they?
Well,
they impose this.
They have a completely unified system, and they have unified command. The Russians provide the equipment, and so there is complete standardization to all the land forces of the Warsaw Pact have standard equipment, and they are completely flexible.
Could I ask you now about NATO? This, of course, was formed in 1949, before you went to Germany.
Yes.
Did you think that was a good thing, the NATO organization?
Oh, yes, very certainly. I believe that one of the most important lessons of the war, the Second World War, was first of all, the outstanding importance of what I call the Anglo-American alliance, and then following from that, the creation and the development of the North Atlantic alliance, which included the Western European countries, and that is fundamental to maintaining the freedom and independence of Western Europe and the United States of America, in my opinion. No, it is absolutely critical and vital step forward, creating NATO. It created a lot of problems on the military side as well as on the political side, and still does.
But do you still feel the United States' presence in Europe is absolutely essential?
Absolutely essential. It's absolutely essential to the strength, the military strength, and the political cohesion. Two things that really matter about NATO are the political cohesion, which is cast in doubt from time to time, and which the Russians, of course, would be delighted if they could damage. The other is that, and the military strength. And both these factors determine the effectiveness of the NATO as a defensive organization against possible Russian aggression.
Yes, you've mentioned the word defensive. That's how NATO was viewed.
Yes, and that remains so. And that is, it's important not to convince not our own people and that it is essentially, there's never been, and never will be, I don't think, any intention of a pre-conflict offensive against the Russians. A preemption, what I think that's the word that's generally described as, a preempted offensive. No, it's always been, and I'm sure always will be, a defensive organization.
Because there was a lot of rhetoric from the Soviet Union, wasn't there?
Oh, yes.
That it was perceived very much as an offensive.
Yes, and there still is. I mean, that their main theme, that the... That sooner or later the West will launch a preventive and preemptive offensive. And they're surprised, I suppose, now even more with the development of nuclear weapons. But at that time, the existence, except for the fact that the Americans were in complete superiority. In fact, the sole owners of a strategic nuclear capability. That was the shield behind which conventional forces sheltered.
Was there any consideration given to the fact that, you know, Russia had been invaded through Europe twice in the 20th century? Was it appreciated that they would be rather paranoic regarding their security?
Well, that's a political consideration.
Yes. The military wouldn't...
The soldier's job is to make certain that he can carry out his role, and the role of the army, the British Army of the Rhine, was to... In cooperation with the rest of the Allied armies, to hold and defeat any Russian offensive against Central Europe, Central Western Europe.
I wonder how early that threat was perceived, you know, the fact that the Russians might go into Western Europe.
Oh, I don't know.
Because you weren't there until 1951, but obviously this had been perceived beforehand.
Well, I think, you see, I think that this is a change that was taking place between 1945 and the time that I was went to Germany in 1951. I mean, when the war ended, everyone was really concerned with any possible rebuilding of the German military capability and a repetition of a war of revenge, like happened after the First World War. That's what most people, and certainly on the military side, I and other people were concerned with. And then the situation changed. And I think the French thinking remained that Germany was the potential future enemy, were the last to change into realizing that Russia was the future, and the Russian Empire was the future potential aggressor and enemy. And this has continued and developed ever since. But the NATO organization was set up as a defensive organization to prevent, deter any Russian ideas of invasion and exert ill will, dominating Western Europe by force of arms.
Was there any fear, you know, regarding the NATO organisation, about a loss of British independence on the military side? Did you ever feel at any time that you were constrained?
No,
particularly having a United States
commander? No, I don't think so. I mean, throughout the Second World War, we'd learnt the critical importance of working together as allies with the Americans in particular, and with then later, as time went on, with the Italians, with the Dutch, with the Belgians, and finally with the Germans.
Yes, it's a long process of education, really, isn't it? Experience.
Well, I think it's more. Yes, it's a long process of a change of hypothesis. For example, I always say that I found problems not only in dealing with the Dutch and the Belgians, and the Americans to a lesser extent, but also with the French. And I remember complaining on one occasion to a chap called Jack Swain, who was in my regiment, who had been a junior liaison officer with the French in the First World War and a senior one in the Second World War. And I was complaining about that the French were supposed to be logical. I don't know what the discussions were about, something to do with the NATO defense plan. And I complained that I found them very difficult and not logical at all. And he said, well, John, what you must remember is that the French are only logical from their own premise, their own hypothesis. So if you are in discussion with them or in negotiation with them about a military plan, you must be sure to start with it. You're talking from the same hypothesis, the same premise. And at that time, I think it's fair to say that the French were still, at that time, in 1951, looking upon Germany as the future potential enemy. And that was their hypothesis. I think it changed. It was in the course of changing then. Ours had changed completely, and so had the Americans. But you've got to be quite sure you're talking about the same thing. You're on the same starting point. Especially when you're in working out plans for Allied military operations.
Did you have anything to do with the Plaven plan? You know, this plan for a European defence community or a European army?
Not to any great extent. I remember inconclusive discussion, a talk with Monty about it on one occasion. It's when they set up Western Union. And I don't think so. I didn't get involved in that. If it had led to greater flexibility and increasing steps towards standardization of equipment, I would have been in favor of it. And as regards the British position, I think I felt it was important that we should retain a voice at the top military table in the NATO planning by retaining the commander-in-chiefships of the Northern Army Group. But gradually that changed, and now I think the commander-in-chief, at the present day, I think the commander-in-chief of the Northern Army Group is a German officer. And the British Army of the Rhine, of course, it's small, it's very efficient, but it is a small component in the Northern Army Group. And that probably is a fair rearrangement of command. But at that time, we were, the Prime Minister and the British cabinet were anxious that we should retain an important position, which was the commander-in-chief of the British Army, of the Northern Army Group, was a very important post in the total overall command structure of the NATO land forces. I suppose that was a matter of national prestige, but gradually, as the Allies have got more and more close to working together, that I think has passed away.
Could I ask you now about the big question of the resuscitation of the German army? You've explained the French position, that they were still perceiving the Germans as late as 1951 as perhaps the main threat. There must have been problems, I would think, about rearming the Germans and getting them to take their part in the defence of Europe.
I think there were. There were very serious problems, but mainly on the political side. As far as the military side was concerned, as I told you, I was told to see Speidel and Heusinger and discussed, open discussions and meetings with them. They came, but it was to be treated as a matter of the highest secrecy. And so they were brought in great secrecy to my headquarters in this wood during this exercise, counter thrust, and I had talks with them. I knew something, of course. I'd been briefed about their history. Beidel had been a very important staff officer in the German armed forces, and Heisinger was a commander. Beidel was both, commander and staff officer. They were both highly competent senior German officers. But it was all to be done in the greatest secrecy. And so, as far as I was concerned, there was no open discussion, and my discussions with my staff were confined to my chief of staff and to these two senior German officers.
What was their attitude towards, you know, taking their part now in the defence of Europe? Were they eager, or was there any hesitation?
It's difficult to remember precisely what the impressions were I got at the time, but I think, looking back on it, and perhaps with the advantage of hindsight, my impression was that they were cautious, very cautious, and they thought they wanted to approach the whole thing very step by step and in a very cautious way. And I think that was the best description I can think from memory of their attitude. And I think that was right.